So, thanks. So, yeah, my name's Pablo Matti. When I was a kid, I loved David Bowie. And, you know, Bowie, he had all these identities. You know, he was Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, the Thin White Duke. But he sort of killed them off as he went along. You know, very famously, he killed off Ziggy at the Café Royal in London in 1974. No, I've obviously sort of brought my identities along with me, as Yosha Buddy mentioned. I hope they're all here in this room. But just before I start, I wanted to check something. If you consider yourself to be a Londoner, would you put your hand up? If you were born in London, would you put your hand up? And if you think you're going to die in London, would you put your hand up? Do the rest of you think you're going to die, or okay? So, Yosha Buddy and Kemal Sheila came to this event that we run. It's called Salon for the City, and it takes a look at London through a different lens every month. And we were talking about it, and they're doing a series here, Dharma in the City. You know, the city is, as you'll see later, is a subject very close to my heart. So I wanted to come to speak, particularly because I wanted to come to say farewell to this building. Because the move's coming, I'm sure everybody here knows all about that. And I'm probably going to be away most of the next few months. So this will probably be the last time I'll be in this building before it's gone. And when I came along to the West London Buddhist Centre, it was down there about a few hundred yards, not very far away actually, Colville Houses, wasn't it? And I can still remember, actually, Paramananda saying to me, come and look at this building, you know, we're thinking about buying. And he brought me here. And it was like, wow, it was so cool, you know. And the move happened, not without resistances and a bit of, you know, it was quite difficult at times. But, you know, Paramananda, he's a sort of benevolent dictator. So he sort of pushed it through. And the move happened. And I must confess, I don't remember the move. I think I absented myself during the hard work, because my next memory is being here. Padma Pani, did you single-handedly decorate the whole place, Padma, I think?
No. Jen helped me and a few other people.
Right.
But that came a little bit later.
Right. But we moved in to this building, and I spent many years here. I used to live just down there. And, so I did a lot of retreats in this place, did a lot of meditating in here. I became a Mitra here. I went and, you know, did all the preparation to become ordained from here. You know, there was a lot of amazing evenings here. There was a lot of reportings in. That wasn't so amazing. But I've got very fond memories of this building, actually, incredibly positive associations. So I wanted to come and say goodbye to it. And of course, I sort of loved this part of town as well, although it's changed hugely since those times. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, what I call urban imagination. What I do. In fact, I'm going to talk about myself, and hopefully, I'll try and sort of make it a bit useful to other people along the way. And I'll tell a story, and I'll talk about London and art and the imagination. And then I'm going to give, right at the end, I'm going to give some hints about what I call gonzo psychogeography. So, okay, stop, right? Now, if you want to close your eyes, you can close your eyes. Because look, we're going to imagine that we're not in this building, this very nice Georgian villa in a posh, expensive part of town. We're actually in a vast underground chamber, and we're surrounded by the sound of dripping water. And the air is thick with a sort of reek, and it's hot. There's water everywhere. And up ahead, across the water, on the wall, there are four giant iron hatches. And in the darkness around us, it's cut across by torchlight. And there are several figures, and they're all dressed head to foot in yellow rubber. It's not an S&M club. And one of the figures beckons to us. And we turn and we follow. And these figures in yellow, and we're dressed in yellow too, by the way. These figures, they enter a tunnel. The tunnel's like about 15 foot high, but it's oval. And it's made out of the glazed bricks, beloved of Victorian engineers. And as we walk up the tunnel, we're walking, wading through water. It's sort of knee high, and it's kind of quite thick and viscous. And as we go up this tunnel, other tunnels join it, and culverts come in, waterfalls, things splash down from above. There's water everywhere. It's very, very damp. The going is getting quite tough, this wading thing, and the distance between us and the figure in front is increasing. So we're quite relieved to come round a bend and see that the other figures have stopped. And they seem to be doing something quite strange. They're all standing around a sort of tank which is at the side of this tunnel. And the only way I can describe it is that they look like they're sort of panning for gold. And we join them and they sort of signal that we should do the same thing. They're putting their hands in and pulling up and examining what they've got. So we do the same. And then one of them nudges us and points. And in our hand, in all this sludge and gravel, there is a small object. And when we pick it up and look at it, it's a silver ring. Stop. So you can open your eyes if your eyes are closed. We're going to rewind sort of a couple of years, about 1,000 miles. And now we're sitting on a rock, on a mountain, at the end of a ridge. It's very hot. There's no water here. Very dry, the sky is this vast blue dome above us. And way down deep, spread out, is this plain. And we can see figures sort of moving across it in the distance through olive groves and almond groves. You can hear the sound of insects, maybe the odd dog barking, maybe a car in the distance. It's a vast plain and it's pretty empty. And we stand up. We walk back along the ridge, over the boulders, till there's a tiny path. And we follow the path, and the path gets onto a bigger path, and the path leads to a trail. The trail leads to a track down the hill to a group of buildings. Now, probably some people here will recognise this scene and where these buildings are. Where is it? Well, it's in Spain. It's the retreat centre. It's the men's retreat centre for people who are going to be ordained into the Western Buddhist order. And I was there in 1998, as was Ratnaprabha. And this day when I walked back to the buildings, it was the last day of the retreat, a four-month retreat. And I've been in the habit of actually going and sitting right on the edge at the end of this ridge every morning and meditating and surveying the world below me. You know, get up there before the heat really kicked in. But this was the last time the retreat was done. And when I was up there, I would reflect on the stuff that was going on this retreat, and a lot of it was very strange. A lot of it was very beautiful, some of it not so, but the strangest thing for me, at any rate, was that in the middle of it, there was a month in complete silence, no speaking whatsoever. Now, I'm sure several people here have done a lot of that. Kamal Shiva actually enjoys it. But it was a very... Well, you get a lot of energy if you don't talk. You know, we spend a lot of energy talking. So, but also in my case, it felt a bit like my personality was disappearing. I mean, it's who are you if you're not talking? That's what I was kept thinking to myself. And you're not, somebody's not talking back at you, reflecting it back. I had a strange experience of, without words, I was sort of disintegrating into small particles. And if a sort of hot wind came up the valley, it might just completely disperse me. But thankfully, we got to the end of the month, and I could speak again. I'd love to tell you that I said something really profound, but I think it was, can you pass the salt? And we're actually at supper that day. But this was the end. It had come to an end, all this stuff that had gone on. It's this psychic adventuring in a way I'd seen it, you know. I was ordained, I was Pabamati now. And it was time to go back. So a truck came, picked us up, drove us down to the house at the entrance to the valley, and from there I think there was another car which went to a small town, and then from small town to a big town, then along the motorway to the airport. When we got to the airport, at some time, so I made a phone call. I rang my partner here in England to say, I'm out, I'm through it, I'm on my way back, you know. But she wasn't there, so I got on the plane and we flew to London. Now, on the plane, as we came up, you know, this is my favourite way to sort of fly back into London. You come in from the sort of Thames estuary and you sort of come up the Thames and you see the river beneath you, and then this sort of city grows around it like a sort of archipelago. And as we were flying in, and it was a grey, sort of typical wet English day, you know, and I was looking down and I was thinking, am I enlightened? And I'd fully expected that I might get enlightened on this retreat. In fact, when I first came to West London Buddhist Centre and I first went on a weekend retreat, I was half expecting that I might be enlightened by Sunday afternoon. I had a lot of confidence in those days or something. But I was thinking, I didn't feel that much different, actually. But we were coming in to land, and I was wondering about this. Anyway, we landed at Heathrow, sort of, you know, zened my way through passport control and all that sort of stuff. And I got back to Latimer Road, down there, which is where I lived. I came out the tube, and it was raining. And I looked up at the tower block where I lived, and a strange sense of foreboding came over me. But I went in. I got a lift to the 20th floor, which is where my flat was. And key in the door, you know, to push the door open, you've got 4 months of accumulated junk mail and pizza advertisements and stuff, you know. So I got in and I sorted all the mail out, and there was a letter, a handwritten letter. And I recognised the writing. It was from my partner. And I opened it, and I read it, and I had to sit down. See, because far from sort of looking forward to the return of an enlightened being, my partner decided that they didn't want anything to do with this enlightened being, and in fact, didn't want any communication about it. It was done. So this is the big opportunity, right? You can test out this spiritual stuff that you've got. You've been on this retreat, you've done all this stuff. Life offers you something which is, you know, it's impermanent, it's insubstantial, it's suffering. This is the moment, right? Was I enlightened or was I a bit enlightened? What do you think? Who thinks I was enlightened? Nobody. Good, because I wasn't. But not only was I not enlightened, this sort of mountain peak of my sort of sort of Buddhism and Dharma and meditation and spiritual stuff that I've been sitting on, it almost immediately just completely collapsed into this plain of pain. And it didn't stop there. A chasm, an abyss opened in the plain and it poured in. And then I followed it. It was very strange. Oh dear. Well, the karmic sort of irony of this person not wanting to be in communication with me after I'd not been in communication before, but it wasn't lost on me, by the way, okay? But all the sort of stuff that I suppose in a way I've been rather dismissive of, having a girlfriend, romance, companionship, love, this simple human stuff, which has seemed, you know, not that important compared with the big spiritual stuff. Well, the scale suddenly swung the other way. That seemed very important. The spiritual stuff didn't seem important at all. Now, I'm going to put Camel Shear on the spot here. It's actually, because he won't remember this because he's had millions of conversations, but I was on King Street with him, and I told him what happened, and he said, it's a great opportunity to develop insight. And he was right. And I knew he was right. But it didn't make any sense whatsoever. The words were completely empty of meaning. They understood them. I understood In the Buddhist context, they understood why. It just didn't work anymore. It had gone. Like that. So, it didn't stop there. I managed to keep a sort of semblance of sort of, you know, I'm an ordained Buddhist and all this stuff. I managed to keep it going, but underneath, I was actually started to go mad. I didn't recognise myself. All sorts of strange things started to happen. For a start off, I became an insomniac. And when I did sleep, I was haunted by these incredibly intense dreams. I can't really describe them. So, to avoid them, I would actually go on huge walks across the city. I'd set out from North Kensington and walk all the way to the Royal Docks. And then come back at dawn, sort of exhausted but wired, you know, still with this stuff. And this was going on, you know, and it went on for quite a long time. There were, you know, friends of mine and my family were very concerned, and other people, Buddhist, Pabapani particularly, I'm very always be grateful for him this, sort of understood it and were sort of with me through it, you know. But I was sort of stuck. And then a friend of mine suggested something to me, and he suggested something to me, something which I'd never, ever considered doing before. He said, "Oh, I know this shaman in West London, you should go and see him." And it's like, I don't do that. I don't like shit. It's like, get away with that stuff. After another week of insomnia and haunted dreams, I rang him up and said, "Have you got that shaman's number?" And I went to see this guy in the very unshamanic district of Brentford. And he lived in a semi-detached 1950s cool house in a cul-de-sac. And I went to see him on a Tuesday afternoon. I can still remember it. And something rather strange happened there. I won't go into it just because I haven't got time. But he gave me this one suggestion to do something. And I did it, actually. And he gave me a couple of the pointers. And then something sort of seemed to have changed in some sort of way. Along with Pabapani, he also suggested stopping running away from these dreams and stuff and sort of paying attention to them. And I started to study Jung on dreams. And in fact, I was living in this flat in Latimer Road and with my best friend who'd come up from New York, and he was in a total mess. And for months we'd do this thing where we'd meet in the kitchen in the morning and we'd tell each other what we dreamed the night before, or, you know, and write it down. And in fact, it formed such a strong psychic bond, that which is still there between us all these years later. We sort of, in a way, got to know each other psychically, I'd say. So, from that time, there were three dreams which really stood out. And the first one, the Al Bowley, the 1930s British crooner, his head appeared to me at Piccadilly Circus. He was a singer from before the war. Now, why this was significant to me is that my father and grandfather used to love that music, and particularly Al Bowley. So when I was a kid, I heard a lot of that, you know, in the next room. And Al Bowley was smiling at me. It was a very positive dream. In the second one, I was near St. Paul's. I could see St. Paul's in the background. There was a crowd sort of walking towards it, and there was a woman, and she turned around and looked at me. And it was the American actress Tuesday Weld from the 60s and 70s. And it was a very sort of romantic, longing sort of connection, you know, between the two of us. And in the third dream, I was in a giant underground chamber, surrounded by the sound of dripping water. Grab a tea here. So, and this dream, which was quite freakish actually, that recurred several times, you know, being in this big chamber. And then one day I read this account in a magazine or a book, I can't remember, about the fact that underneath London, there are many rivers. There's not just the Thames. There's rivers flow down from the hills in the south and the hills in the north. But most of them, for most of their length, are submerged. They're buried now. They once flowed openly, but they're now covered over, squashed into drains and ditches and pipes and stuff. But the thing which really interested me about it was that you can't get rid of a river. You can sort of build over it and squash it down, but it's still there somewhere. And the one I was particularly interested in was the biggest one, which is the River Fleet. I'm sure people have heard of that, which flows down from Hampstead Heath, down through King's Cross, through Clerkenwell, past St. Paul's and Blackfriars, down to the Thames. And I decided, as sort of people who are going a bit mad do, that I had to go and visit the River Fleet. So I contacted Thames Water, who was sort of, you know, controlled all that stuff. And I lied. I bluffed and I bullied and I badgered them and I found the right person to speak to and I flattered him and I pretended that I was a Sunday Times journalist and I did all this stuff. And then one day I came home and there was a message on my answer machine said, if you want to go and visit the fleet, you have to be at a Hackney Wick pumping station at 5:30 tomorrow morning. Somebody will show it to you. I was so excited that I set off at 1 o'clock and walked there. And when I got there, there wasn't somebody waiting to show me the River Fleet. There was a whole gang of sewer men waiting for me, the Sunday Times journalist. And we got into their van, which is full of kit. We drove through the city, first light, down to Blackfriars, and they parked up, and we all got kitted out in yellow rubber and gear, masks and stuff. We got out of the van. One of the guys, there was a manhole, and you know, tool in, picked it up. There was a shaft with a ladder. Went down the ladder. We went along a passageway, down another ladder, round a bend, through a labyrinth, then down a flight of steps, till we came out in a giant underground chamber, surrounded by the sound of dripping water. And yeah, this was where we started this story, and it was the chamber from my dream. These four are giant hatches, by the way. The fleet comes down. This is the place where the fleet would have met the Thames, just under this end of Blackfriars Bridge. Now, it's actually diverted into a big Victorian sewer, but when it floods, when there's a storm, it rushes over that and pushes open these four iron doors and empties into the Thames. So, as I said, we were there. We walked up the tunnel. We sort of panned for gold. I found my silver ring, not this one, but it's a ring. And, of course, they knew about these places because they walked the system. And you can't possibly understand a system like the London sewage system by drawings and descriptions. It's a sort of oral knowledge that's passed on between the sewer men. And there are certain places that they know. For some reason, small, valuable items are liable to collect or get caught. Earrings, rings, money, stuff like that. So whenever they walk past that way, maybe once every 3 months, 6 months, who knows, 18 months, they'll stop and have a look. And they're lucky on me, the first time I've been down there, I found a ring, right? It's a bit like Bilbo. So I was feeling pretty pleased with myself, but then something happened. There was this sort of hot, warm wind started to blow. And as soon as that happened, the leader of the gang of sewermen immediately got on his radio and started to talking to somebody on the surface. And I could tell the atmosphere changed. These guys suddenly, something urgent was going on. And what it was is that it had started to rain above. And if it, particularly if it's a storm or a heavy downpour, it's very dangerous in the sewers because they fill up really quickly. And in the old days, what they used to do is that the guides left on the surface would pick up the manhole covers and clang them so that anybody who was down there would know and come up. Of course, they've got technology now, but this wind is the tunnel up river, if you want to call it that, up sewer, which is full now full of filling it with water, and it's pushing the air down, right? Quite a force. So they immediately started powering on, and I was following them. But, you know, if the going had been tough before, now it was unbearable. My sort of hipster urban thighs were screaming in protest, you know, and it was getting deeper. And the distance between me and them was, they didn't seem to be taking any notice, they were getting further away. And all my notions about underground rivers, lost rivers, and young, and dreams, and Buddhism, they didn't mean anything. I just didn't want to die stuck in a drain under Blackfriars Road. So I was mightily relieved when the guy in front of me suddenly climbed up and out and then turned back and helped me up and out, because the water was coming up. And we went along a passageway, and we went up a ladder, along another passageway and up another ladder. And then they lifted up a manhole cover, and we came out, and we were in Clerkenwell, and it was raining. So I spent another very happy hour and a half in the back of their van. The guy with the van came and met us. And they told me some of the tales of the underworld, you know, the London underworld. Not the craze and stuff, but the sewers, the real London underworld. And some of those stories actually were quite spooky, and some of them were quite moving. And these guys, I think, had been through something together a little bit, so they sort of trusted me now. So they told me some very interesting stuff. I haven't got time now, sadly, to go into that. But it was time to go. It's time to go home. And so I got out, I said goodbye to them, and I walked home in the rain. And when I got back to my flat, I had various pieces of musical equipment around and stuff. I wrote a song. And it's called I Love the Rain. And I felt happier than I felt for months. And I think the reason is that I'd actually lived my dream. I'd found this underground chamber. And I decided that I was going to try and live my other dreams. So I started to make music which was influenced by stuff from the 1930s. Stuff that I remembered from when I was a child. And I started to record and eventually release it under the name Tuesday Weld, which then became the real Tuesday Weld for legal reasons. And all sorts of other things started to happen. But it wasn't this sort of end of this romantic, erotic madness at all. It wasn't even the beginning of the end. It was the end of the beginning, possibly. And actually, that's the end of the beginning of my talk, so I'm just going to take a swig of this. So, anyway, that was then. What about now? Right, so this is actually quite a long time ago. It still feels very recent to me, but it's quite a long time ago. So, as Yasha Bodhi said, now, you know, I live in Vauxhall now. I lived in Clerkenwell for many years, but I live in Vauxhall now. I've got two kids. I'm very happily married. You know, I've released 6-7 albums of The Real Tuesday Weld, toured the world. You know, we've done a lot of stuff. I wrote film soundtracks and all this stuff. And, you know, my life is predominantly involved in the arts in London. And I feel incredibly fortunate and privileged to be in that position. So, what happened in between? Well, the thread that kind of connects it all is London and the city. And as well as having the Real Tuesday Weld, we've got a production company, an arts production company called Antique Beat, and we do London events. Yasha Bodhi mentioned one earlier. Salon for the City every month. Takes a look at London. London blood, sex, drugs, death, graffiti. In May, we did a huge event on the London Eye called 32 Londoners. There are 32 capsules on the London Eye because there are 32 London boroughs. And we put a speaker in every single capsule giving a talk about one of 32 significant Londoners. Everybody from Thomas Becket through to Zadie Smith. We're doing a London Month of the Dead in October. So we do a lot of stuff about the city. And the connection between now and then, for me, is London, actually. Because something happened during that time in the sewers and afterwards. The city became like a being. It became personified, I suppose, in a sort of, if you looked at it in a kind of pagan way, which people don't usually about cities, but or in a Greek way, it somehow became alive. And I really mean this because my experience of it was very emotional. You know, I mean, I couldn't even get off at West Kensington Tube Station for about a year and a half. There would be a bench in Soho Square I couldn't walk past. The bollard where Kamal Sheila gave me the teaching about insight, I can still picture it. This corner meant something, that corner meant something, the parapets meant something, not just personally, but I started to feel like the boundary between myself and the city had become quite permeable. Sometimes that was quite frightening. I remember being on the platform at Russell Square Tube Station, and the tube came in, and the doors opened, and a guy got off, and he looked at me, and then he walked through the wall. And I turned around to everybody else, and nobody had noticed. And I had to go and ring a friend to come and get me. I was so shocked by it. And I remember walking in Gray's Inn Road with my head down and looking up and seeing a guy leading a row of sheep down the middle of the road. And when I looked again, he was gone. So some of this stuff, it was actually quite disturbing, and some of it very positive, but it did change my relationship with the city. And in a way, I feel like I've been living it out through my music. I've written a lot of music specifically about London. I made a whole album called London Book of the Dead. And of course, these events that we're doing now are really a way of trying to communicate that passion for the city and that experience of the city to other people, and to actually try and experience it with them, to bring people together, to look at this big being that we live in, called London. Now, you might say, Padmati, that's really fascinating, thanks for letting us know, but what's it got to do with Buddhism, and the Dharma, and the city and stuff, right? Well, the answer to that is, I've got absolutely no idea. No, the answer to that is, I don't think I knew for a long time, actually. But don't get the wrong impression. Even when this stuff happened, I didn't reject Buddhism. I didn't think I'd seen through it, that it didn't work. I certainly didn't reject the Western Buddhist Order. I never wanted to resign, you know, as an order member. I never thought I could find a different teacher than Sangharakshita, or I'm now going to be a shaman, or I'm now going to be a Jungian. I didn't never thought that stuff at all. I knew the truth of the Dharma, but I realized that somehow I'd gone about it the wrong way. And the best analogy I can use, of course, is I'd built a city of my Buddhism. And it was a beautiful city. There was alleyways and courts and towers and temples. But the thing is, it was built on sand. There was no foundations. And there was no sewers. And when the earth moved, as it does, from beneath, from the shadow side, unexpectedly, the whole thing just crumbled into dust. There were a few buildings left standing, for sure. But I realised that if I was going to rebuild it, I couldn't really rebuild it. It was London after the Blitz. You know, I could build a new city, possibly. But if I built it in the same way, the same thing would happen. Probably. So I knew that I had to start with the foundations. In fact, I had to start with sewers. In fact, I had to start with the shit. But when I'd been in the shit, I'd found this ring. So I started with the ring. It sounds a bit like Lord of the Rings here, isn't it? and somehow, in that sort of seed, I can link myself back now to that time. And I still don't really know what the connection is between what I do now and Buddhism and Dharma, but I'm getting a much stronger feeling for it the last couple of years, you know, that I'm actually feel like I'm doing some good work, you know, in the world. And one of the reasons that I think that is that because I really believe in the arts. Now, We live in an extraordinary city. It's nothing like the city in the world. It's an extraordinary time. There's never been a time like this. This city is full of culture. You can dive into the arts, and it's free, a lot of it. And it's the reward, the way I see it, it's the reward for the expense and the hassle and the stress of living here. So make sure you get your share of the reward for all the shit that you go through in the city. That's one thing. Now, of course, Buddhism has always talked about the arts. That's not new. And, of course, the Western Buddhist Order has talked about the arts a lot. There's art centres, Buddhist art centres. And Sangharaksha has written about the arts, you know. I wouldn't necessarily recommend the books to you because of the way they're written, in a very arch tone, which I think is a bit off-putting for most people these days. But the central premise of his book, The Religion of Art, is that the arts, or he says art, can take the place of religion in our society, possibly. Now, I believe that. I would say the arts rather than art. But I think culture has got a pretty good chance, actually, of, for a secular society, of actually making it sacred. So I believe in that for sure. But I'm going to finish up with something a bit less abstract and, yeah, wouldn't it be nice if we're all artists and stuff like that. I'm going to talk about what I would call gonzo psychogeography. Is anybody familiar with the word psychogeography? It's been bandied about quite a bit over the last few years.
Gonzo.
Ian Sinclair and himself. Well, psychogeography really means, if you could translate it as spirit of the place. Psyche, soul, possibly the soul of the place. So it's, in a way, it is that experience of the animation of your context, your physical context, perhaps experiencing it in an emotional way, psychological, psychic way. So what I call gonzo psychogeography is getting in there. Now, I haven't been to the other talks on Dharma in the City here, so I don't know what they were. But, of course, I understand that, you know, this city is a difficult place for a lot of people, particularly younger people. Particularly, you know, if you don't own a property, you can spend your whole time working just to pay the rent, you've got to get on crowded tubes, you know. It can be very painful, for sure. Let's not pretend otherwise. And so, of course, one way of responding to it in terms of Dharma is to sort of, you know, talk about building a refuge from it, retreating from it, you know, or at least how to cope with it, how to survive it, or maybe how to surf it or something, right? Well, I'm not talking about that stuff. I'm sure that all works. But I'm talking about diving in. Because I think there's some opportunity, if you do that, to actually experience yourself in quite a different way. So I'm going to give you 10 tips for urban gonzo psychogeography, okay? Now, right, so wherever you live, wherever your house is, do you know when it was built? Do you know who lived there beforehand? Even if you live in a tower block, do you know when it was built? And if it's a tower block, what was there before? Find out more about the place that you actually live. Where do you work? Do the same thing. Particularly if you work in the City of London, it's full of myths and legends and stories. So get informed about the place that you live, the piece of land that you occupy, however temporarily. And that's number one. Number two, walk between where you live and where you work whenever you can, even if it's a really long way. Set aside the time to do it, to explore the connection between where you work and where you live. You'll see the city in a very different light. You'll see your work in a very different light. Number three, walk the routes of the lost rivers. A friend of mine wrote a book called Walking the Lost Rivers. You can get a book with maps which show you how to follow the traces of those rivers, like the Fleet. There are many of them. You can still see the traces of them in the cityscape. You can see the streets dipping down into valleys. You can see roadsides, Fleet Street, Fleet Lane, Turnagain Lane, Turnmills, all these place names that refer to a hidden river, because you can bury a river but you can't get rid of it. So take a walk on the lost rivers of London. With a friend, take a night walk. Set off from your flat or your house at 1 or 2 in the morning. Pick a destination and walk there. I'm saying walk with a friend because I don't want to get anybody getting in trouble, but you'll experience the city in a... I'm not talking about the West End. I'm talking about the docks or Limehouse or Bloomsbury. You'll see the city in a completely different way. You'll see a whole bunch of people that you never normally see, the night workers. There's a whole race of them. Go to a different museum. This is number 6. Go to a different museum every week. Now, the thing is, there's loads of big museums in London. We know about them. But have you been to the Operating Theatre Museum, where you can see where they used to dissect people in front of an audience like this? Have you been to the Grant Museum of Egyptology? Have you been to the Royal College of Surgeons and seen the Yeti's finger? You can go to a different small museum for free every week for about 3 months. Go to the Guildhall or the London Metropolitan Archive, a huge treasure trove of documents and maps and photographs and ephemera and records about the people who've lived in this city. And you'll find that actually your sense of narrow self is expanded and is broken down, because there are 11 million people in the city now. The whole world has come to London. I can't, if I walk from my house to my daughter's primary school, I'll hear 3 or 4 languages spoken on the way. But if you go to the Guildhall and London Metropolitan Archive, you can see the records of the Londoners before us. And they were just like us, mainly. Go on a guided walk. I've got several friends who lead guided walks. It's amazing. Lots of them are free, right? But you can pay 5, 6 quid and somebody will take you around a part of town which looks quite dull and boring. But by the end of it, you'll see it in a completely different light. Geoffrey Marsh took me on a walk. The guy did the Bowie exhibition at the V&A. Took me on a walk. Bowie's Soho. Right? You can't see anything of David Bowie there. It's just Soho. It's just street names. But by the end of it, you understood how David Bowie became David Bowie. Because he spent all this time in Soho at advertising agencies and bungees. And it all kind of seemed to make sense. Number 9. Take a boat trip from Vauxhall to Greenwich. It's cheap now. London is a river city. The reason this city is here is because of the river. It was the first place you could ford the Thames if you're coming from Europe. If you see London from the river, you'll have a very different experience of it. And number 10 is... come to Salem for the City, last Thursday of every month. That's an advertisement. So I think I'm going to end it there, actually. But so what I would say is, or offer up, not as an instruction, but as a suggestion, is that if you want to practice Dharma in the city, you could try practicing city in the Dharma. Thanks a lot.